I'm delighted to be here again at Seattle Insight, and so wonderful, your beautiful space you have, and all the programs you're offering now in this space. It's great. So this evening I want to tell you three stories of women who lived at the time of the Buddha. And I got interested in this material because I had been translating the Jataka tales, and I was aware that in each of these stories of the Buddha's former lives, he was born as a male monkey or a male elephant or a king or a prince or... And I thought, oh, we need some stories of the women and the young women, the older women, and what their experience was. So a few years ago, I had a chance to really focus on developing a repertoire of stories that explored women's experience. And I was struck by how the senses and sense perception was very much a part of their encounter with the Buddha's teachings, and how in that sense, their experience, their stories, relates very much to our own lives and our own opportunities to encounter these teachings and really apply them in our own lives, and to see where we too can find doorways, gateways, that open us to a deeper understanding of the truth of impermanence, the truth of the origin of suffering, and all of the magnificent teachings that offer us myriad ways to awaken and transform the mind and heart. So I'm going to tell three stories, but as an added bonus, we have some music. And I'm very pleased to have, for many years, been able to perform with Doug, who plays this drum, which is, he's going to tell you a bit about, which actually was played at the time of the Buddha. So,
we had been performing for some time before we discovered, well, we didn't discover the cave paintings, but they're cave paintings in the caves of Ajanta that, where the Jataka tales that Margot translated are depicted. And in those cave paintings, there are women playing a drum that looks a lot like this. So that was kind of fun for us to realize that we were echoing some ancient thing. This drum is called Mridanga, which I like the word itself. It, Mrid means earth, and Angam is limb. So it's like a limb of earth. It's sort of a koan for me. What is that? Like it's nice. My teacher was fond of saying that it outnumbered him because this drum has two heads and we only have one. So it's kind of high tech. It's been around for, you know, more than a couple thousand years. And it's the only drum that is actually tuned to a pitch. It's actually tuned to the tonic of the song that's being sung. And it's stretched very tight. There's goat skin underneath, and then there's buffalo skin, two layers of skin. And the goat skin has this black spot that's applied to it. Even though it's pulled tight, the black spot drops the pitch down, so it's audible. It's more. Makes a pitch. So that's the drum. They're done now. There's some other things I'll rattle around with too.
So as you listen, I like to think of how our sense of hearing is so evocative and can take us, like even the sound of the train, it takes us away to another time, another place, a memory. So as you listen to the sound of the drum, just allow it to transport you to the world of ancient India. And I will also be playing this drum, which is a modern invention, but inspired by many world instruments from different cultures. And it is called a hung drum. And it comes from, believe it or not, from Switzerland. So please, Doug.
Ta, 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 ta,
Once, in ancient India, in the city of Kosambi, in the household of Gosita the banker, a baby girl was born to a young slave woman. It was a difficult delivery. When the midwife handed the baby to her mother, she said, "This one is special. See her little hunchback? Some say it is a curse. I say it is a blessing." It was true. Even at birth, one could see a tiny hunch on the child's back. Well, she must have been given another name, but everyone called her Kujutara, which means little crooked back. It was said with great affection. She grew up in the busy household of Gosita the banker. Her mother instructed her well. "Pay attention, know when to speak, know when to be silent. Keep your ears open and your eyes as well." When she was only a little girl, it was discovered that Kujutara had the gift of perfect recall. Any poetry that was recited, any snatches of conversation she had overheard, she could repeat exactly as they had been spoken. Her master, Gosita, began to send Kujutara on errands into the city to deliver messages to his clients and customers. Accompanied by her mother, she would set off, repeating what Gosita had said to her. And then when they arrived at the home of a customer, she would repeat it word for word. Well, she became a valued member of the household, and she grew up. Gosita was an ardent, devoted disciple of the Buddha, and he especially loved to hear the Buddha give a teaching on generosity, and he was always seeking new ways to practice and cultivate giving in himself. And when the king of Kosambi took as his wife the beautiful orphan whose name was Samavati, then Gosita decided to send a gift that was precious to him indeed. He sent young Kujutara to be a serving woman in the queen's household. Well, it was a big change for Kujutara, but she soon discovered that Queen Samavati was kind and good-natured, and she too love to send messages to friends and family in the city of Koh Samui. And while the queen did not have freedom of movement, Kujutara did. She loved to wander under the flowering margosa trees and stop by the Yamuna, the quickly flowing river. And standing there in the shade of a banyan tree, she would take in all the sounds of the city. Water flowing down a gutter, or the wind making a soft clattering sound in the shiny leaves of the banyan tree. Elephants splashing in the shallows of the river. Elephants spraying water from their trunks. Water poured from the throat of a jar. Or the pitter-patter of the rain on the roof of a market stall, coming faster and faster and faster, faster than any drummer. As she listened to these sounds, Kujutara felt her heart grow quiet and still. Surely there was a great teaching in the sounds of the world. Well, Queen Samavati grew fond of Kujutara. They were about the same age. The queen had been given the gift of beauty, while Kujutara had the gift of an attentive mind and a powerful memory. The queen loved to decorate her chambers with flowers. She began to send Kujutara to buy flowers from the gardener Sumana. She gave her 8 pieces of silver, 8 silver coins. Well, the weight of them in the little purse, the solid weight of them, what a pleasure. And the jingling that they made as she carried them through the streets, Kujutara was so delighted. She went straight to the gardener's home. She demanded the best flowers, the most flowers, for the queen's money. And one by one, she handed out those coins. And soon one basket was filled, and soon a second. And she had only spent 4 of the 8. Without really thinking about it, she said, "Oh, that will be plenty." And back she went with the 2 baskets and the 4 coins jingling in her purse, and gave the flowers to the queen, and the next day set off again, and again returned with 2 baskets full and now 8 coins in the purse, and the purse growing heavier and her conscience beginning to trouble her. Well, this wasn't her money. Well, what was she doing, keeping it? And as she had this thought, she was passing by the market, and she saw a young beggar child reach out for a piece of fruit from a market stand, and then be chased as the vendor ran after her. Kujutara called out, "Come, come." And one child, and then another, and then 12 children stood around her, and she gave them those coins. She said, "Now go, buy yourself fruit, rice cakes, rice balls, anything you can find, and share it with the others." And off they went scampering, shrieking with delight. And Kujutara felt very happy, and felt somehow that she was distributing the queen and the king's wealth as it ought to have been distributed. And so it was. Every day she spent 8 coins, 4 on the flowers, and 4 she gave away to the children. They began to wait for her, leap around her, and kiss her hands, and offer to help her with the baskets. And every day she glowed with the happiness of giving. Now Sumana, the king's gardener, was also a follower of the Buddha. And one time he invited the Buddha to come and receive a meal in his home. And he saw how young Kajutara glowed with happiness. And it seemed to her that she would appreciate the Buddha's teachings. He invited her to come and hear the Buddha. And that's how it happened. One fine morning, this young slave woman, who had received no education and no opportunity, she stood in the doorway of Sumana's home, listening as the Buddha gave a teaching on generosity. And even before she perceived the meaning of his words, somehow the resonant tones of his voice reached into her and touched her. The Buddha spoke. Kajutara listened as she had never listened before. He said, Evanche bhikkave, satta janeyam. O monks, if beings knew, dhanasam vipakasa vipakam, if beings knew the fruit of giving and sharing, if beings knew the power and the result of giving and sharing, na adatva punjeyam, they would not eat without having given. Even if it were their last morsel, their last mouthful, they would not eat without having shared if there were someone there to share it with. On hearing these words, Kajutara, she had this sense that here was the sound of the wind, here was the sound of the stream, here was the sound of the rain on the roof, here was the sound of truth. And something settled deep within her, something unwavering, unshakable confidence and trust. Well, on that day, she spent all 8 coins on the flowers. She brought back baskets full and gave them to the queen, and the queen said, But Kajutara, where do all the flowers come from? Where have you been? And why are you so radiant, like a flower yourself? Well, Kajutara confessed that she had been spending only 4 coins on the flower garlands, and 4 coins she had been giving to the orphans in the streets. But that doesn't explain it. Tell me, Kajutara, you have seen someone, you have heard something, I must know. And Kajutara said, I have heard the Buddha, and this is what he said. Satta janeyam. He said, if beings knew, if beings only knew the power of giving and sharing, na adatva punjeyam, they would not give. They would not eat without having given. They would not let a meal go by without having shared whatever morsel, whatever mouthful they had at hand, if there was someone there to share it with. Well, the queen was moved by these words and by these teachings. And she said, but Kajutara, what about the children? And reaching into her purse, she gave Kajutara coins. And Kajutara went back to the market where the children had been waiting for her. And she shared the queen's silver with them. And after that, Queen Samavati sent Kajutara not just to buy flowers from Sumana, not just to share with the children who roamed the streets of the city, but to receive the teachings in one of the many monasteries of Kozambi, whenever the Buddha was there in residence, at Gositarama, at one of the others. And Kajutara, with her keen memory, with her attentive mind, she would bring back these teachings and offer them to the queen and the members of the queen's household. And Kujutra is remembered through the centuries as the one who was the origin and the source of one particular collection of teachings in the Pali Canon, the Itivutaka. And her name doesn't appear there except in the introduction, because she insisted, even though she was transmitting these teachings, it was just what she herself had heard. Itivutaka, thus have I heard. But we must remember that a messenger is always more than a messenger, and the teachings that Kujutara received were filtered through her own perception, through her own experience, through her lived experience of giving, of sharing, of living in the world. That is the story of little crooked back, Kujutara. To another city in ancient India, we come to Savati. Once in ancient India, in the city of Savati, the king, King Parsenadi, married a young woman who was no daughter of a neighboring king. She could not play the veena. She had not learned the 37 arts. She could not recite poetry. She did not have a vast array of maidservants and slave women at her beck and call. No, she was the daughter of a garland maker. She had not learned to spend her days in idleness. No, from a young age, she had been working. Her name was Mallika. And how Mallika came to marry a king, well, this is the story I shall tell you. Some say it was all because of a gift she gave one morning on her way to the flower gardens. It is a feast day in Savati. Everyone is wearing a flower garland today. Why, the noblemen, the fine ladies in their horse-drawn chariots are stopping to buy garlands in the market. Garlands festoon the house fronts. The temple gods are wearing garlands, and even the elephants are wearing garlands today. In Savati, the garland makers are famous for their skill. Here you can find a garland with a peacock feather, one or two, woven in among the blossoms. You can find garlands with horn or bone, ornaments, even berries, shells, or fruit. Mallika had been weaving garlands and cutting flowers from a young age. She knew how to make a strong foundation with the munja grass, or the stalks of cotton plants, or slim reeds, and then, taking the slender blossoms, long-stemmed and short, she would weave them in and create her garland, making sure not to bruise the petals, for who would buy a garland if the petals were torn or the flowers were bruised? She had the gift of gracefulness and the gift of appreciation, and knew which colors blended well together. The white angel wing jasmine, the Malabar jasmine, the water lilies, blue and green. Now, one day, Mallika was on her way with her younger sisters to the flower gardens. Each one of them carried in one hand a shallow basket and in the other a small earthenware pot with a handle and a lid, in which there were three portions of rice cooked in broth, flavored with ghee and spices for their noontime meal, prepared by their mother. As they walked through the streets, Mallika was tuned to all the beauty of the world. There was the brilliant green of the neem trees outside the king's palace, and there, a fragrant honeysuckle bush, and a beautiful ruby-throated hummingbird dipping its long beak into the throat of the bloom. But now, as they approached the gates of the city, she saw two monks. She knew they were monks, for they were bareheaded and barefooted. They wore saffron robes, and one shoulder was bare, and on the other they carried a bowl, for they were on alms round. And as she saw them, Mallika, on impulse, skipped forward and bowed to the first of the two monks, and they were so radiant, so peaceful, so calm. And the one monk slid his bowl before him, while Mallika lifted the lid of her little earthenware pot and dipped the three portions of rice that would have been her meal into the Buddha's begging bowl, for indeed it was the Buddha. And then Mallika knelt before the Buddha and bowed and touched her head to the ground, her heart singing with joy at having given this gift. And then up she came and scampered back to her sisters, who said, "Why did you do that? Who was that monk? Did you know him?" Mallika only smiled. And off they went through the gates of the city. Now, it is said that the Buddha only smiles when he too has a reason. And his cousin, who was his attendant on this day, Ananda, said to the Buddha, "It seems to me that the Buddha is smiling, and indeed a great blossoming grin had bloomed on the Buddha's face." And Ananda said, "Tell me, why is it that the Tathagata is smiling on this day?" And the Buddha replied, "This young woman is the daughter of a garland maker. Today she will become chief queen of Savatthi." Meanwhile, the Buddha, as he returned on alms round into the city, saw in the distance, approaching the gates, King Pasenaji. Indeed, it was the king. He was riding his great stallion, but neither king nor stallion looked happy or alert. The stallion was spattered with mud. The king was bone weary and exhausted. He was returning from battle with his neighbor, Prince Ajatasattu. He had been defeated. He was discouraged. And as he came up to the gates of the city, he heard a young voice singing, "Malakaradita, Mallika. Malakaradita, Mallika. Malika makula kumuta, Malika makula kumuta, Kalahara kamala kuvalaya, Kalahara kamala kuvalaya. Well, this young woman's voice was somehow as refreshing as a drink of cool stream water. And the king, exhausted from battle, bone weary, he approached and followed the sound of this voice. Malakaradita Malika, Malakaradita Malika. And into the flower gardens he came. There was this young woman cutting flowers as she sang. And at the sound of the horse approaching, Malika looked up. Why, it was the king. Boldly she came forward. She took the king's horse by his bridle and led the great stallion through the garden to the lotus ponds. Meanwhile, the king was enchanted, entranced, and addressed her with the first question that came to his mind. Maiden, I must ask you, are you married? No, Your Majesty, I am not wife to any man. May I rest here? May I rest here in your company, in this peaceful place? Indeed, Your Majesty, you may. He slipped from the back of the stallion and let the animal drink, and Malika made a pillow of reeds, and the king lay there with his head on her lap and told her of his defeat in battle. She stroked his forehead and listened, and he slipped into a half dream, and when he awoke and saw himself in this enchanted place with the lovely face of the young garland maker's daughter gazing down at him, he knew that he could not be parted from him, not then, not ever. He set her before him on his horse. He took her to her own home. He requested of her parents that she become his wife. And then in the evening he returned in a horse-drawn chariot and brought her back to the palace and set her on a throne of jewels. Well, King Parsenadi and Queen Malika were very happy together. And he did great things for her, indeed, but she did great things for him as well. It was by her request that Ananda came to the palace and gave teachings. And it was through her, through Malika's insistence, that Parsenadi went himself to hear the Buddha speak. And he became a devoted student of the Buddha. And the years went by. And one evening, king and queen strolled on the terrace together, watching the moon rise over the river. And the king looked at his beloved wife with such fondness, with such deep admiration and affection. And then the thought came to him, it is only because of me that she has been able to donate a monastery to the Buddha. It is only because of me that she has grown in beauty and generosity. Really, it is only because of me that she has become such beloved member of this community. He said to her, Malika, I must ask you this. Is there anyone you love in the world? Or shall I say, whom do you love best in the world? Malika looked at her husband, her king, with such affection. She loved him even when he was short of temper or vain, or told the same story over and over again. She looked at him, but she could not tell a lie. She said, "My beloved, I must tell you that of all the world, I hold myself most dear." Parsinodi was taken aback. She saw that he was shocked by her answer. She said, "My beloved, I must ask you to answer the same question. Who is it that you hold most dear in all the world?" Well, he paced away from her on the terrace. He paced back, he paced away. He came back, he said, "It is true, I hold myself most dear, but I am the king." He was quiet that night. And in the morning, he went to see the Buddha and he told him of his conversation with Queen Mallika. He said how he had been somewhat perturbed by the queen's answer to his question. But the Buddha reassured him. He said, "No, Queen Mallika has answered well. For one may travel the whole world with one's mind and heart and find no one more deserving of one's love than oneself. For whomever loves himself or herself cannot and will not harm another." Well, Queen Mallika, King Parsinodi, they had their ups and downs, their times of the cold shoulder, the silent treatment, but they were devoted. And many times the Buddha had to reconcile them. And when Queen Mallika died quite young, after giving birth to a daughter, King Parsinodi mourned her, not just as his beloved wife, but also as his teacher. Queen Kema had no desire to meet the Buddha. No, she had no desire to go to Velavana, to Bamboo Grove, and hear the Buddha speak. Her husband, King Bimbisara, was somewhat surprised. He wondered why it was that Queen Kema didn't wish to hear the Buddha. She made any number of excuses. There has been a dispute among the maidservants. I am required to resolve it. Or, there is a storm coming. Surely it is not wise to go this afternoon. One excuse after the other. Finally, King Bimbisara approached one of the maidservants, who was a distant relative of the queen, and he said to her, "Do you know why? If there is perhaps some reason why Queen Kema doesn't wish to hear the Buddha speak?" The young maidservant let out a trill of laughter. The king was surprised. He said, "Well, what is it that's so amusing about my question?" She said, "It comes from your being a man, you see. Any woman would know why the queen refuses to go and hear the Buddha speak." She gestured to the queen's chamber, where gorgeous tapestries covered the walls, and a beautiful vina, the four-stringed instrument, sat by the window. There were silk carpets on the floor. The maidservant explained, "You see, Queen Kema loves beauty. She is surrounded by beauty. In the morning when she wakes, when she strolls into the garden, in the evening when she listens to music and singing and recitation, her life is one experience of beauty after another." The king was growing impatient. He said, "Well, yes, and?" She said, "Your Majesty, it is like this. Queen Kema is afraid that the Buddha will reprimand her. She knows that he counsels against attachment of any kind, and especially attachment to form. She doesn't wish to be reprimanded, and Queen Kema doesn't wish to change." I see," said the king, understanding at last. He went into the garden, and there under one of the udumbara trees, with its long hanging blossoms, giving off a scent of honey and cinnamon, he found the queen in rapture, surrounded by the beauty. He smiled and enjoyed with her the pleasant breeze in the afternoon, and he had an idea. Now, the Buddha often came to Velavana, and indeed, it was perhaps the most beautiful of all the groves that had been given to the Buddha. There were lotus ponds, there were winding trails among the trees, and in different parts of the grounds one could find a quiet pavilion where monks or nuns would be sitting in meditation, and deep within the grounds one might be lucky to find the Buddha giving a teaching. Well, some days later, the king approached the queen. He said, "Kema, my dear, I have a special entertainment for you this evening. I have hired some musicians, some poet-singers, and they will sing to you of a place of great beauty that is not far away. Indeed, it is said to equal the heaven realms in its magnificence." Kema was puzzled and intrigued, and she came. And that evening, the poet sang in many verses, extolling the magnificence of this place of burbling streams, where the birds sang, where the swans swam, where the trees flowered. And at the end of the evening, Kema turned to her husband. She said, "Could it be that this song I have heard this evening is a song of Velavana?" And he nodded. And she said, "This is a place that I must see. I must go there." And her husband Bimbisara said, "Indeed, my dear, you must go." Well, the next day she set off on her own and entered the gates of Velavana and began to wander among the trees, listening to the streams, watching the birds alight in the flowering trees. And as she wandered deeper and deeper into this sacred grove, memories, odd images began to come to her. In one small pond, she saw a swan floating and nibbling on reeds that grew by the shore. And a memory came to her, or an image, of another swan, only this other swan was golden in hue and spoke in a human voice and sat on an embroidered cushion and gave a teaching. And this somehow was a dream from which she awoke. Well, how could this be? She had no memory in this lifetime of having encountered a swan who spoke in a human voice. Puzzled and intrigued, she came deeper and deeper into the grove. And there she came upon the Buddha giving a teaching. She hadn't expected to find the Buddha there, and she nearly turned around and made her way back to the gates, but something stirred within her, somehow knowing she was in exactly the right place at exactly the right time. And the Buddha saw Kema standing there, and he prepared to give her exactly the right teaching. Kema all of a sudden became aware that there was a young woman standing beside the Buddha, and this young woman was lifting a palm leaf fan, and she was fanning the Buddha with such a graceful and elegant gesture. And this young woman, why, she was celestial in her beauty. Her skin shone, her hair was long and lustrous, her eyes sparkled. Kema said to herself, "However beautiful am I, this young woman is 10 times more beautiful than me." She watched her in admiration, in fascination. But as she watched, she noticed subtle changes. The young maiden's arm, why, it moved more slowly. The skin about her neck began to hang in folds. Her waist began to thicken. Her hair grew less lustrous, was streaked with gray, and the skin on the fine bones of her face, it was changing. Her eyes no longer sparkled. Kema was astonished to see this young maiden age before her eyes and then suddenly drop the fan, fall to the ground, lifeless. And then she understood the teaching that the Buddha had given her, and he spoke a verse. "Those who are attached to passions fall back into the stream like the spider on its self-spun web. But the wise proceed, having abandoned all attachment, having abandoned all expectation. And having received this teaching, and having heard these words of the Buddha, in that very moment, in a flash, Queen Kema became a sotapanna, a stream enterer. Like Kujutara, she had unwavering confidence, unwavering faith in the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. But even more so than Kujutara, she attained to the second, the third, and the fourth stage of awakening. She was a completely realized arahant." Well, a message was sent to King Bimbisara. And King Bimbisara came, and the queen asked his permission, and he freely gave it. And she entered the order of nuns and became chief among the Buddha's nuns and in the community of nuns as the one with depth of insight and understanding. And the young nuns who came to her for instruction would often receive a teaching about the wise relationship to beauty, the wise relationship to the beautiful things of the world, whether those are those we apprehend through the senses, or whether those are the beloved and pleasing who are dear to us. This is the verse.
Yeyuragaratanupattanti sotam sayamkatam makatakko vajalam etampi jatvana vajanti dira anapekino sabadukam pahaya.
Those who are attached to passions fall back into the stream like a spider on a self-spun web. Having cut off even this, the wise proceed, free of expectation, relinquishing all suffering. Just a couple of words about Kema. So this lightning swift nature of her awakening when she sees the young maiden grow old and die before her eyes, it really suggests how a slight shift in perspective is sometimes all that is needed to reveal a truth that has been in plain view all along. A truth perhaps that we couldn't see because of deep conditioning. So Kema's insight into the nature of impermanence and the truth of change. It frees her mind and allows her to transform her attachment into wisdom. So, here are three stories of young women at the time of the Buddha. And maybe we'll just sit for a couple of minutes and you might reflect on these stories and which one of them or which aspect of them is speaking to you. So just maybe closing our eyes and taking our posture again. So, thank you. So I just really appreciate your attention and your presence and the opportunity to share these stories with you. I'm very fond of these three women, and I love to tell their stories. And. Is there any question or any? I might just say that the one wonderful source for stories of women at the time of the Buddha is the Terigata. So these are the poems of awakening of the first Buddhist nuns. And there are a number of different translations available. And on Access to Insight, some of Thanissara Bhikkhu's translations of these poems are there. But there are also commentaries on these poems. And you could say that these are the oldest poems written by women, sacred poetry by women in the world, really. I mean, perhaps Sappho, perhaps there is some Greek poetry that is older, but it's a pretty amazing collection. And to think that these verses were handed down orally through the centuries. So I have left a few index cards and a few pencils at the door. If you want to write a comment, your feedback would be appreciated. Sort of, I'm developing these stories because in the Jataka tales, you have often a very definite beginning, middle, and end to a story. Whereas these stories, I'm taking an incident from the life of one of these characters, and I'm looking for the dramatic potential in the story. So where is their tension, and where is there an actual narrative that can be unpacked and explored? So I'm very interested to know if the stories, from the listener's point of view, have enough dramatic and narrative juice to keep your attention. So, I think that Lindell might have a few closing announcements.